And we're going to continue a bit. If you joined me late, we had power went out just as we were about to get started. So I'm going to go a little bit further. I hope you can hang in a bit longer. Continuing with our chapter 2 of anti-systemic movements, dilemmas of anti-systemic movements. Division of labor, centralization of capital. We have dwelt at length on but one face of the ongoing structural transformation of the capitalist world economy. That seen through a focus on the plane of the interstate system and its constituent units, the states, and their relations with one another. We have done so for two reasons. One is the seemingly enduring disposition on the part of historical social scientists to carry forward, all evidence to the contrary notwithstanding, the liberal ideological distinction between state and economy, or state and market in some versions, as if these were fundamental theoretical categories. My interjection, all evidence to the contrary, notwithstanding. Recall what we learned from Jeremy Bentham. And bear with me, please, because this gets to the heart of our present dilemma, the one we noted last week, that today our three friends will show in their heads up from 30 years ago, that being, we do not know our opponent. And if we don't know our opponent, we can't be in a class struggle. Far better to call it an ambush in the dead of night, in which we're overpowered, forced face downward to the ground, hands tied behind our backs, blindfolded, put under the strictest of controls, the only information we can think piped in direct from their megaphones to our ears, while simultaneously being thrust and harnessed, carrot to the front, whip to the back, made to be simple energy so that a system can be fueled continuously. And the nature of that system is not for our discussion, but imparted to the rulers generation after generation. And while we resist, just as my parakeet friends mentioned in Unpacking Democracy fought the cage, this resistance is intuitive, not a struggle in the sense of fighting to end a system that puts us in a cage, is set on naming us, telling us what we are, such that we never can discover it. Ambush, beat, and break is perhaps what we should call it, what they've done to us. But back to Bentham. This is him speaking in his Rationale of Judicial Evidence. Quote, an incredible fact, say that the liberal distinction between state and I'm adding this example, say that the liberal distinction between state and economy, or state and market, is ideological, continuing. An incredible fact owes its incredibility to one cause and to one cause only, disconformity as supposed to the established course of nature. To produce disbelief of the existence of the matter of fact in question, this disconformity must be such as, in his judgment, to render its existence incompatible with a certain portion, at least, of those other numberless matters of fact, of the existence of which he has been persuaded by the indeterminate but ample mass of evidence above indicated. When the improbability, that is the apparent, the relative improbability of an alleged fact, is set in the balance against testimony, it's still at bottom little more than testimony against testimony. Of the facts of the existence of which a man is persuaded, the knowledge, the persuasion, is derived partly from his own perceptions, partly from the alleged perceptions of others. But in the unmeasurable mass of facts, which, at least in a country where civilization is tolerably diffused, the most ignorant man is said to know, the number of those of which his knowledge is derived from his own immediate perceptions, from his own individual experience, is small in comparison with those for the knowledge or supposed knowledge of which he stands indebted to the experience or supposed experience of others. And my interjection, do you see how class can in all fairness be called totalitarian? Consider how this is shown by the following, continuing. Concerning individual facts, so far as mere perception, exclusively of inference drawn from perception by judgment is concerned, no force of exterior evidence can either increase or diminish the degree of persuasion of which such perceptions cannot but have been productive. But in regard to species of facts, there is not one, perhaps, concerning which the persuasion derived by a man from his own experience would not be capable of being overborne by allegations of contrary experience on the part of other men. What makes our confidence so entire, as it is in regard to the existence of those species or classes of individual facts, the existence of which is announced by the phrase which exhibits as the cause of it, this or that law of nature, is that so often as it falls in his way to make the trial, a man finds his own perceptions in relation to them confirmed by the reputed perceptions of all other men without exception. That, and my interjection, that is key, has always been key. That is why states must engage in surveillance and oversight of what we hear, what is said, what we see. Because what we think must be confirmed by all other men without exception. I mean, we should be discussing this if we truly had an educational system early on in high school. We should be preparing our young people to do battle with these folk who want to name us, claim us, turn us into subjects for their benefit, not for humanity's benefit. Their agenda is not ours.